All right, welcome back to the deep dive.
Yes, hello.
Today we are going to take a look at Minnesota State Board for Community Colleges v. Knight.
Oh, an interesting one for sure.
Yeah, it's a Supreme Court case from 1984.
Oh, okay.
And as always, we have some sources lined up. We're going to do a deep dive into this case and figure out
Yes.
what's going on here, what's important about it for our listener.
Absolutely. And for the law students out there who are listening, this is going to be a really good one for you
Yeah, definitely.
because it gets to the heart of this question about First Amendment rights in the public sector.
Yeah. So maybe to kick us off, how would you sum up the core question this case is asking?
Okay, yeah. So at its heart, this case really boils down to whether the First Amendment actually guarantees public employees like these community college faculty, Yorga Armin, where we're talking about the right to participate in government policymaking processes.
Okay, so it's not just about can they say whatever they want on their own time?
Right, exactly.
It's about their actual involvement in how policies are made.
Yes, are they entitled to have their voices heard by the government when it comes to these policy decisions?
Okay, so to give our listeners a concrete example, what was going on in Minnesota that led to this case?
Okay, so Minnesota had this law called the Public Employment Labor Relations Act, or PILRIA.
Okay.
And this law set up different ways for public employees to engage with their employers on workplace issues.
Okay.
And there were kind of two main tracks.
Okay.
One was this meet and negotiate process, and this applied to the really essential things,
Yeah.
bread and butter issues like wages, working conditions.
Yeah, the core stuff.
Absolutely, the core stuff.
Yeah.
But then there was this other framework called meet and confer, and that was more for discussing these non-mandatory policy issues.
Okay, so if it's not about wages and hours and things like that, what kind of stuff are we talking about here?
Yeah, so think about things that relate to their employment and how the colleges function, but not those core economic terms.
Yeah.
For the community college faculty, it could be things like curriculum development, academic policies, things like that.
So it sounds like the faculty would actually have a way to shape the policies that affect their work.
Yeah, in theory, it provided them with a platform to share their perspectives with the administration.
Oh, okay. But there's a twist, right?
There is a twist.
That's why we're talking about this.
Exactly right. And it's a twist that goes to the heart of this First Amendment question.
Okay, tell me more.
So under PILRIA, when it came to these meet and confer sessions on these non-mandatory policy issues, the colleges were only required to meet with union representatives.
So not every faculty member.
Right. Not every individual
Okay.
faculty member,
Yeah.
only the exclusive representatives chosen by the employees to represent them in a union.
So the union was the only voice that got to participate in these meetings.
That's how the law was set up, yeah.
I see. So how did the non-union faculty members feel about this?
Well, as you might imagine, they weren't too thrilled.
Yeah, I can imagine.
They felt that this arrangement violated their First Amendment rights.
Specifically, what parts of the First Amendment were they concerned about?
Well, they pointed to the freedoms of speech and association.
Okay.
They argued that by restricting the discussion to only the union's perspective, the government was essentially silencing their own views on these really important policy matters that directly affected them.
So they're saying, hey, we might not be union members, but we still have opinions and we want to be heard.
Exactly.
Makes sense to me. So how did this all play out in the courts?
So the case starts in the district court in Minnesota.
Okay.
And initially, the non-union faculty actually won.
Really?
Yeah, the district court agreed with them that these provisions of PILRIA were infringing on their constitutional rights.
Wow. So it seems like a pretty clear-cut victory for them at that point.
It did seem that way, right?
Yeah.
But as often happens with these big constitutional questions, this wasn't the end of the story.
Of course not. It goes all the way to the Supreme Court.
That's right.
So for our listeners who are studying law, what was the central legal question that the Supreme Court had to grapple with?
So the core issue was whether this restriction limiting participation in these meet and confer sessions solely to the union representatives, whether that actually violated the First Amendment rights of those faculty members who chose not to join the union.
Okay, so the Supreme Court had to weigh the state's interest in kind of streamlining these policy discussions with the individual rights of these faculty members.
Exactly. And it's a question that gets to the heart of how much power does the government have to control who gets to participate in these kinds of policymaking conversations?
Yeah, that's a really big question.
It is.
All right, so what did the Supreme Court ultimately decide in this case?
Well, Justice O'Connor wrote the majority opinion.
Okay.
And she laid out a pretty clear principle right from the start.
Okay.
She said that while the First Amendment protects your right to speak your mind, to associate with whoever you choose, and to petition the, you know.
Right, the classic First Amendment freedoms.
It doesn't actually guarantee you a right to be heard by the government.
Okay, so that's a really key distinction.
Absolutely.
You can say what you want, but the government doesn't necessarily have to sit down and listen to you.
Right, it's a question of, do you have a right to have your voice heard in these specific settings, in these policy-making settings?
Okay, and what was the reasoning behind this principle? Like, how did they justify that?
Well, Justice O'Connor cited a previous case, Smith v. Arkansas State Highway Employees.
Okay.
And that case had already established that public employees don't have a constitutional right to force the government to listen to them.
So they were building on existing precedent.
Exactly.
Okay.
And there was a really important quote from that case. It said, appellees have no constitutional right to force the government to listen to their views. They have no such right as members of the public, as government employees, or as instructors in an institution of higher education.
Okay, so that sets a pretty high bar for what the government is obligated to do in terms of listening to individuals.
Yeah, it suggests that the government has a lot of leeway in deciding how it structures its own policymaking processes and who it chooses to engage with.
I see. So applying that to this specific case, what did the court say about the union's role as the exclusive representative?
Right. So the majority argued that this arrangement actually promotes efficiency in policymaking.
Okay. So having a single voice representing all the employees can streamline things.
Exactly. Right? Okay. And, you know, it's not like the non-union faculty were completely silenced.
Right. They could still, like, write letters to their representatives or something, right?
Exactly. They still had all those other avenues to express their views.
Okay.
Justice O'Connor specifically noted that the state has in no way restrained appellees' freedom to speak on any education-related issue or their freedom to associate or not to associate with whom they please, including the exclusive representative.
So their broader First Amendment rights were still protected.
Right. But the question was, did they have a right to participate in these specific meet and confer sessions?
And the court said no.
That's right.
Okay, I see. So was there any discussion about whether these meet and confer sessions themselves should be considered like public forums where anyone could participate?
Yeah, that's a really important point.
Yeah, because if it's a public forum, then the government can't really restrict access as easily.
Right, exactly.
So what did the court say about that?
Well, they said that these meet and confer sessions didn't really meet the definition of a public forum.
How come?
Because they weren't open to the general public. They were designed for a very specific purpose, you know?
Yeah, like a back and forth between the administration and the elected union representatives.
Exactly. And that limited purpose allowed the government to control who participated.
I see. That makes sense. So what about the whole issue of academic freedom?
Right. So this was a big part of the non-union faculty's argument.
Yeah, especially in a university setting.
You would think so, right?
Yeah.
They said that their academic freedom was being infringed upon by not being able to participate in these policy discussions.
Okay. And how did the court address that argument?
Well, they acknowledged that faculty involvement in governance is really important as a matter of educational policy.
Okay. Right? So they're not denying the value of that.
Right. But they said that it doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional right.
Okay.
They said, the academic setting of the policymaking at issue in these cases does not alter this conclusion. Faculty involvement in academic governance has much to recommend it as a matter of academic policy, but it finds no basis in the Constitution.
So they're drawing a line between what's good practice and what's actually required by the Constitution.
Exactly.
Okay, I got it. But I'm guessing not everyone on the court agreed with this decision.
Oh, absolutely not. There was some pretty strong dissent.
Okay, let's hear about those.
Okay, so Justice Brennan, for example, he argued that this law essentially put non-union faculty in a catch-22 situation.
Oh, okay. What do you mean by that?
Well, he said that if they wanted to have their voices heard on these policy issues, they would have to join the union and associate with the union's views, even if they disagreed with those views.
So they're being forced to choose between their individual beliefs and their ability to participate.
Exactly. And he saw that as a burden on their First Amendment rights.
Yeah, that's a tough position to be in.
It is.
Okay. And were there any other dissenting opinions?
Yeah. Justice Stevens also wrote a dissent.
Okay.
And he focused on the concept of viewpoint discrimination.
Which is a pretty fundamental idea in First Amendment law.
It is.
Yeah.
He argued that by giving the union exclusive access to policymakers, the state was basically giving preferential treatment to the union's viewpoint and silencing other perspectives.
So it's not just about who gets to speak. It's also about whether the government is favoring certain ideas over others.
Right. And he saw that as a violation of the principle of neutrality in the marketplace of ideas.
Okay. That's an interesting perspective. So two pretty strong dissents. Were there any other opinions worth mentioning?
Yeah. So Justice Marshall, he actually concurred with the majority's outcome.
Okay.
But he did raise some concerns about the majority's reasoning.
What was he worried about?
Well, he was critical of the broad language that suggested that the government has very little obligation to listen to citizens before making policy decisions.
So he agreed with the result in this case, but he didn't want to set a precedent that could be used to justify ignoring citizen input more broadly.
Exactly. He was trying to limit the scope of the ruling.
Okay, that's interesting. So even among the justices who agreed, there was some debate about how far this principle should go.
Right. It highlights the complexity of these issues.
Absolutely. So for our listeners who are, you know, future lawyers maybe working in public sector law, what are the key takeaways from this case?
Okay, so first and foremost, this case shows that the government has significant discretion in deciding how to structure its policymaking processes.
They're not obligated to give everyone a platform to speak.
Right.
Okay.
And this has major implications for public sector labor relations.
How so?
Well, it essentially gives a lot of power to unions as the exclusive representatives of employees.
Even on issues that go beyond like traditional collective bargaining.
That's right.
Okay. I see. And in terms of like legal concepts, what should law students really focus on here?
Okay. So there are a few key things.
Okay.
First, the public forum doctrine.
Right. We talked about that.
Yeah, make sure you understand why the court said that these meet confer sessions weren't public forums.
Yeah, that's a key distinction.
It is.
Okay, what else?
Second, look closely at the concept of compelled association.
Okay.
And how Justice Brennan used it in his dissent.
Right, he said the non-union faculty were being forced to join the union if they wanted to participate.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then finally, there's the issue of viewpoint discrimination.
Okay.
Which Justice Stevens raised in his dissent.
Right. He said the state was favoring the union's viewpoint.
Exactly. So those are three really important concepts to grapple with.
Yeah. This case packs a lot in.
It does.
So to sum up for our listeners, what was the main holding of this case?
Okay. So basically, the Supreme Court said that public employers aren't required by the Constitution to listen to non-union employees on non-mandatory policy issues. If they choose to only talk to the union, that's okay.
Okay. So it's a pretty significant win for unions in that sense.
It is.
Yeah.
It reinforces their role as the main channel for employee input.
I see. So to wrap things up, why is this case still relevant today? What should our listeners be thinking about, even if they're not going to be labor lawyers or anything?
Yeah. So this case really raises these fundamental questions about the balance between efficient government and individual rights.
Right.
How do we ensure that government can function effectively while also protecting the voices of those who might not be part of the majority or the officially designated representatives?
Yeah, that's a tough question.
It is. And it's something that we still grapple with today in all sorts of contexts.
Absolutely. So a lot to ponder even beyond the specifics of this case.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thanks for walking us through this. I learned a lot.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
It's always good to revisit these landmark cases.
All right. And to our listeners, thanks for joining us on the deep dive.
Yeah. See you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.